United States against McGee.
May it please the court.
Mr. Nash.
Thank you, Judge. I wonder if we could imagine for a moment that we're privy to the jury deliberations in this case. And after several hours of discussion, before any vote has been taken, one, two, three jurors voice some uncertainty regarding the government's evidence. And a fourth juror at the end of the table picks up Exhibit 9 and Exhibit 10 and tells the jury, here is Judge Adelman's finding that the defendant has committed, is committing, and continue to commit the crimes charged, the same crimes that are charged here and which we're deciding. Can we say that that occurred? Certainly not. But we can't say it didn't occur either. In a case that this court decided, United States versus Gray, well, I'd begin with Olano, the Supreme Court case. It says that the error, to be plain and to be recognized and to cause reversal, must be real and be determined to have had an effect on the jury's verdict. In Gray, a case decided by this court, Judge Evans decided that in a similar situation,
this court speaks as an institution. The author of a given opinion is not relevant.
I'm sorry.
You heard me say that to another lawyer already this morning.
Well, I've heard you say it before. I didn't hear it today.
But it's still irrelevant.
Okay. In a decision of this court, United States versus Gray, the court said that the risk of prejudice is real. In this case, different from any case that I can find, because even in Gray, it's unclear that the orders went to the jury. Here they went to the jury. We cannot say that this did not impact the jury's decision. We might want to view the evidence as overwhelming. I never knew a prosecutor that didn't take that position. But in this case, overwhelming or not, the defendant is entitled to have the jury decide his case on admissible, relevant evidence. This was neither relevant nor admissible. This court had spoken before in Cunningham that it was not and that it was reversible error. The government cites McMahon, but McMahon was tried before Cunningham was decided by this court. In the Supreme Court's decision saying that we must bear the burden, and I recognize that, the burden cannot be that I have to present to this court a transcript of the jury's deliberations and point with certainty to the...
It wouldn't be admissible.
That's true, Judge, but it wouldn't exist either. And so I say that...
No, you may not know. Any juror can turn his cell phone to record in his pocket these days.
That's true,
but
too.
Even if it exists, it wouldn't be admissible.
True. In fact, if we follow the trial judge's instructions to the jury to the letter, as this court has often said we must, the jurors considered all the evidence and all the exhibits. So we often say that the court told the jury not to pay any attention to extrajudicial comments, statements, and press, and we consider that they followed the judge's instructions. Here we must do the same. The trial court instructed them to look at all the evidence. How can we not assume that they looked at these two exhibits? We can't. And therefore, it seems to me that the defendant has borne his burden of showing the court that it was error, that it was plain, that it was obvious, and that it would affect the jury's decision. As to the sufficiency of the...
So plain, why did it go right past defense counsel and an experienced district judge?
Well, Judge, I anticipated that question. I don't wish to be flippant, but I wondered if we shouldn't blame General Services Administration that there was mold in the courtroom and everybody was asleep that day, because there is no other explanation. I've tried cases before Judge Clavert, and as you say, he's a very experienced, able trial judge, but it didn't. Nobody objected. Nobody thought a moment about it. As to the sufficiency arguments, I think the brief makes them as well as I could here, and I would rely on the brief. As to restitution, the restitution argument, the government somehow argues that I didn't include it in the summary of the argument and the issues. They're correct. It very clearly is identified in the table of contents as an issue. It's presented in the brief, and in the district court and the prosecutor equated restitution with loss. That's not the case. It should not be, because loss includes relevant conduct. It's
also a plain error issue. Was there
yes,
any
none.
Objection here?
Not
the prosecutor's brief here argues waiver. Says the defense actually conceded that restitution could track loss. And if that's true, that would be waiver.
Actually, I think what the prosecutor does, he mentions that the figures are contained in the loss, and the prosecutor agree, or the defense lawyer agrees with the figures. The fact that there's a difference between loss and restitution is never raised. I don't think it can be said by any stretch of the imagination that the defense counsel recognized the difference and that he agreed to it. He just didn't do anything in this regard. So I would say the argument is preserved as plain error again. It's mentioned in the brief. It's raised in the brief. And here also, it's a matter of law. Loss is not restitution. And restitution does not include relevant conduct, which in this case the loss figure did. Unless there are questions, I would save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. Nash.
Thank you.
Ms. Jacobs.
May it please the Court, Michelle Jacobs for the United States. I'll start with a restitution issue only because that's where you left off. And
don't spend a lot of time on that.
If you'll want to talk about the Cunningham issue, we're interested in how this could possibly happen. This is a deliberate violation by a prosecutor of doctrines of this court, a deliberate attempt to get hearsay in violation of the Confrontation Clause. And this is serious misconduct.
I do not stand here, and in my brief, similarly, I do concede that there's error. There's no doubt that that was error, that the foundational...
Often there are mistakes made in a criminal case by the prosecutor. This was deliberate.
I disagree, and obviously it's not...
Opening. This is where he begins. This is where the prosecutor starts.
I guess I don't understand exactly what you mean by that, Judge, but I absolutely agree that there was an error here. There's no doubt about that. The foundational questions that were asked should not have been, and I've conceded that in the brief. I think there were there's two things, or two areas that I guess I want to spend my time with relative to that. The first is, obviously, this is... either, well, in part, I think, a waiver case, in that when the evidence is, when those two exhibits are offered, defense counsel indicates affirmatively he has no objection to their admission. Now, again, that's not to say that it's not error that they went in, but certainly he has agreed to the admission. With respect to the foundational questions, I don't disagree with you that it was error, but I think there is a distinction between what was asked in this case and the responses that were given, and that in Cunningham. There is definitely the decision in Cunningham repeatedly talks about the relaying to the jury the opinions of these senior lawyers about the evidence, that there was probable cause and that that's what their opinions were. That's not what the agent says here.
Well, Ms. Jacobs, Let me first of all say, professionally, I appreciate that you're here.
Thank you.
I think it's most appropriate that the United States Attorney be here for this case. And I also know, or I believe you know, the high regard I have for you professionally.
Thank you.
But what concerns me, to the point you've raised, is when Agent Strong is about testifying to the wiretap, the AUSA says after the Agent Strong, Special Agent Strong, noted that it was signed by the judge, it says he's a federal judge sitting in this building asking that question. It sounds to be gilding the lily a little bit. And speaking a little bit to the bootstrapping of the admittedly the problem you had with Cunningham.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's this case troubles me because of a collection of errors, and as I see it, and perhaps you could unbundle it for me and see if there's room. Aside from the Cunningham problem, this practice of more than one closing argument, so to speak, in a relatively short case is troubling to me. And I guess against the backdrop, in my view, as I went over the briefs and the record, that all the counts are not overwhelming, frankly. And that's not uncommon. You know, you have stronger counts, you have weaker counts. But in a case where we have the problem with Cunningham, and then this, and I guess I want to ask you, is that the practice?
No.
Is either Judge Clavert's practice or the Eastern District's practice? I just have not confronted this situation.
Right.
So it's that package together
that
causes me great unease with the case.
Well, let me start by saying no, that's not the practice. And, in fact, we had never heard of it until Judge Clavert raised it in this case at the final pretrial about 2 weeks before trial. So, and I'll get back to...
Was there an attempt to dissuade him from that when he raised that?
I don't believe so by either party. I mean, I've spoken at length with the AUSA, and there's plenty of off-the-record, material that I could try to present to you. But, again, I don't think that's appropriate in terms of your consideration of the case and what the parties thought about this idea. But with respect to that interim summation issue, number one, there was no objection. As I've argued in the brief, defense counsel was given an awful lot of opportunities to object and did not. I mean, at some point, I think,
well, there's no question.
Presented with it.
Mr. Nash says we didn't have a sterling performance in that regard.
Well,
I guess my concern is even recognizing perhaps not an A performance by defense counsel with regard to this. And just looking at our supervisory case, it causes just such an unease.
But I really would ask you to really take a look at what is said in that interim summation. I'm not here to recommend the practice by any means, but he literally gives no argument. He does a bullet point summary of the evidence that's been presented as to each of the counts in a matter of 6 or 7 minutes, I believe. It is so different than the cases that talk about this and how problematic they can be, that the Second Circuit case in particular, rhetorical questions, asking the jury to start thinking about the evidence, all those things. That just didn't happen here. So
if you compare this to what the Seventh Circuit Jury Project recommended, and the Jury Project recommended interim summaries, are there differences? And if so, what are the differences between what happened here and the Jury Project's recommendations?
I'm not specifically familiar with the Jury Project's recommendations.
Neither of the briefs discussed it, but the Jury Project was clear. This was tested in district courts around the circuit, and the members of the Jury Project were unanimous in supporting this practice, although perhaps not the style of summaries that were given here. I don't know whether Judge Clavert was involved in that test. It's conceivable this was one of the cases.
that may be, I don't know, that was never put on the record or discussed as far as I know. But again, I think really what happened is, at least at the final pretrial when this all was raised, this was anticipated to be a longer trial. I know the defense counsel suggests otherwise, and as the trial progressed, it progressed a lot faster, I think, than anybody anticipated.
Yes, Judge Cliver was part of the Seventh Circuit Jury Project test.
Thank you. But again, I think he anticipated, I mean, he says we're going to give you the second Friday of trial off. I think it was anticipated to be a longer trial. It probably would have been better to rethink it when they got to the point that they did and the summations were given, or the summation was given. But I think it is important to look, number one, at how sanitized the AUSA summation is. And secondly, Judge, with all due respect, I disagree as to the strength of the evidence. It may be that a particular count was stronger or less strong.
Well, I wasn't speaking to the total, whether it was totally there was sufficient. I just suggest that the counts, as one looks at them, and is perhaps some is a little stronger than the other.
Absolutely.
But what I find a little troubling is what Mr. Nash raises as an adjunct to the Cunningham violation is the sending of the exhibit.
I'm not here to suggest that it was not error to do that. Sending the exhibits back, though, is waived. I mean, counsel said this was not, there was no objection to those exhibits going back. And in fact, when you look at counsel's cross-examination relative to the Cunningham issue, he brings it up again. I mean, he talks to the agent about the approval process and how far it went up the chain and did the attorney general look at this and that sort of thing. This, I think there was a lot more of an undercurrent of whether or not anybody trusted wiretaps generally. Now, I know what Cunningham says,
doesn't that position become of significance if it's raised? Are you suggesting that the defense raised the wiretap issue early?
As he points out in the reply brief, it was raised during the voir dire process, and there was a lot of skepticism by a lot of potential jurors. And I think that was, again, it's not an excuse for the error that was made, but I think there was sort of a cloud in the courtroom about that kind of skepticism. But I want to get back to the standard of review, because that really, I would submit, controls in this case. This is McMahon. Yes, it happened. McMahon happened before Cunningham was decided. But putting that aside, this is a plain error case. And while these two issues that you've pointed out may be error, I would strongly urge the court, in assessing the plain error standard, to affirm here, because we had 16 witnesses take the stand and describe Mr. McGee's extortionate activities, payments that they had to make, checks that were returned, and demands for cash instead, and the like. I mean, every one of these 16 business owners, we had recordings of that extortionate activity. Mr. McGee demanding money, not saying it's not enough, sending a bagman over for more money, and the like. So that when you look at that, when you look at the wiretap recordings, I understand this is about the foundation for the wiretap, but this is not an argument that those wiretap recordings should not have been played for the jury, only that there was too many foundational questions asked. Those wiretap recordings were coming in, and they similarly, his voice is on those recordings, both the wire and body recordings, calling himself the gatekeeper, demanding these money, telling them who they're supposed to pay, collecting these monies. So that were we in the Cunningham situation of an objection having been made, perhaps this case would be different. I don't know. But we're not. We're in a case just like McMahon where the plain error standard applies. And given the evidence, again, there may be a count here or there that you think is stronger than others. There are certainly some that are completely overwhelming. The Ajit Singh count involving Ajit Singh, the gas station owner, Mr. McGee is on tape demanding $2,000. And Singh says, I can get you $1,000 now. They pay him $1,000 immediately. He's on the wiretap calling Jack Adele saying, where's the other $1,000? He's on body recordings talking about whether or not it was $20 short, you know, of the $2,000 payment. There is overwhelming evidence as to many of these counts. And overall in the trial, I would submit also completely overwhelming evidence. And so coming back to Judge Easterbrook, your question at the beginning, and that is, this was a mistake, and it should not have been made. Again, there are certain off-the-record things I can give you explanations for, I think, why it was made, but I'm not sure that really matters. It was not an intentional mistake by this AUSA. It was not. It was a mistake, but it was not an intentional one. And given the standard of review here, I would submit that given the, I can't recall exactly how many pages of transcript, there's one reference by the agent to the probable cause standard in his affidavit. There is no argument at all in those interim summations. Under a plain error standard of review, I would submit that when you read this record, this defendant, he didn't get a perfect trial. He did not get a perfect trial, but he got a fair trial. He had every opportunity to challenge all of the evidence, and all of this evidence was coming in, other than perhaps these two wiretap orders.
I think on these interim argument things, I think it's important that the all the districts, if they're going to use them in criminal cases, it's a personal view, give serious thought to how long the case is and make sure that both sides are in agreement that that's going to aid and not have it morph into some individual practice by various district judges as to whether they're going to use it or not. I'm just offering that as a
I don't disagree at all. And as I said, I think that when this was raised with the parties at the final pretrial, I think everyone anticipated a different sort of case in terms of length, certainly. And you know, they were talking about doing it at the end of that first week.
Did you give any thought to, or would it not be perhaps more prudent to make that decision at the end of the government's case as opposed to in a pretrial conference?
I think that's right. And as I said in the brief, I believe, I think that the best practice here, perhaps they talk about it during a final pretrial conference as a possibility, but the best practice would certainly have been to have revisited the issue and whether or not it was still needed when the government's case was coming in so much more quickly. And if it's going to be at the end of the government's case, you know, perhaps that would be a better place to do it. I will say, though, that, you know, when you look at that Second Circuit case and all of the concerns about, you know, sort of pulling the presumption of innocence out from under the defendant and theories of defense and the like, the government's case was all but over here. There were some financial records that came in and some jail recordings. That was all that was left. And so I don't think the defendant here was put in the situation that they were in a case like Yakovitz, where he really was having to present his defense as the case went along.
I think given this, the whole belief or the whole idea as to the interim arguments is really designed to give the jury an advantage of being able to perhaps get the evidence in smaller chunks rather than at one final swoop at the end of the case. And if the parties realize that the case is almost over, it would seem that it is not practical to do those interim arguments in a case that is going to be on the precipice of having it concluded. So I think that that's an issue that perhaps should have been addressed. I think the interim argument, as you have pointed out, was not an argument but was a recollection of what the evidence had been, and that there was no need for that in this case. But I don't know that I would think that the fact that it was given was of such movement that, if anything, it affected the right of the parties to, again, almost immediately to give a new summation of the evidence.
If I may, just briefly to comment on your comments, I don't disagree with anything you said, really. I think it should be considered as the case goes along, and whether or not timing-wise this was the right time to do it, perhaps not. But I will say, going back to that Second Circuit case, they talk about if you're going to do these in criminal cases, that the model for them ought to be an opening statement, not a closing argument, because of all of the structural error that they had just pointed out. This was nothing more than that kind of an opening statement, given that there was absolutely no argument in it. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Nash?
Very briefly, Judge.
When the government called Agent Strong, They asked Agent Strong a question about the background of the investigation and why it was begun. And Agent Strong's answer was, we had determined that the defendant was involved in bribery and exploitation. 6 pages later in the transcript, a similar question is asked, and again, in an effort to get before the jury what should have not, the FBI agent tells the jury, we already had enough evidence that we could prove these crimes were occurring. This precedes the introduction of the court orders. I don't know what the motivation was or the intention of the prosecutor, but I think that what this court said in Cunningham is doubly true, triply true here. It was inserted, introduced into evidence to prejudice the defendant, and that's exactly what he did. And that the government would stand here and say that a cloud existed regarding the efficacy of introducing and using surreptitious tapes, and it comes from the questioning of the jurors, is somewhat disingenuous. The questionnaire was sent out to determine so that they could get rid of that and put it to rest. And when the case goes to trial, the judge tells the jury, these are legal. That's the end of it. That's a legal decision. And that was done here. The last point that I would make is, in its pretrial brief regarding the overhearings, the government cited Cunningham. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And Mr.